Welcome to the Esri and the Science of Wear podcast. What's happened in the chilly waters off the Scottish coast holds promise for the future. Almost 30 years ago, local divers Howard Wood and Don McNeish noticed devastating changes to the fisheries off the Isle of Arran. They started COAST, the Community of Arran Seabed Trust, for improved marine protection and management. This has sparked similar initiatives across Scotland. Howard says that's because they use geospatial technology to communicate their progress.
Because it's quite a small area, you're never that sure. And that's where things like geographic information systems and story map really come in, because it means that we can tell the public sometimes quite complex scientific data in much easier to understand format.
Howard Wood tells Esri's Karen Sullivan that successfully raising interest in protecting the seabed under those dark seas relied on geospatial tools.
Howard, welcome to the Esri and the Science of Wear podcast.
Thank you.
The success of the organization that you co-founded is a story of perseverance, of patience, and plain old effort over more than 30 years. Let's talk about how this organization started.
I started diving in 1974, and I absolutely loved it. You know, to me, diving was like exploring the unknown. Every dive, you were discovering new things. Back in those days, the added bonus was you would head home with some scallops or a crab, or even, if you were lucky, a lobster.
Tell me about what you saw happening over time as you continued to dive.
In 1982, I'd become a dive instructor at that point, and I trained a local man called Don McNeish, and we started to dive quite a lot together over the next few years, actually up until very recently. So that was 1982. In 1984, the government scrapped a piece of legislation that was called the 3-mile limit. And that was a limit on what bottom-toed trawling, they couldn't approach within 3 miles of the shore. Now, at the time, we didn't really think much of it, but when myself and Don carried on diving over for the next 6, 7, 8 years, we started to notice a huge change. Basically, every dive, you'd be missing specific species that we'd see in the past. Features were disappearing. This was the shift in baseline syndrome. It's the idea that generations perceive their environment as normal when they were growing up. So when they're a child or a teenager, that's what they expect their environment to be. But in actual fact, it's already a degraded environment from the past. And basically, what we were seeing wasn't just a generational change that was not noticed as much. This was a change within 4 or 5 years of a rapidly declining marine environment, which was right off our villages and made a huge difference to both our diving, but also the lower impact fishermen and recreational sea anglers. We went from having lots of fish to catch in different fishing festivals to within less than a decade, hardly anything to catch.
And so as you were diving, what was the experience for you? Were you just seeing fewer species?
We were seeing fewer species, but what we were seeing, because inshore, we were seeing an increase in scallop dredging. Now, that's a fishing boat towing a dredge that dredges the seabed. And so after it's been there and it goes up and down all day trying to catch as many scallops as it can, but the problem is it destroys the seabed. It destroys habitat. The seabed is important habitat for many species. It's like the foundation of our seas. And if you're just left with sand, gravel, and mud, you've got very little habitat left. And so you get fewer crabs, you get fewer little prawns. With this fewer habitat, you also have less fish because they've got less to feed on. They've got less natural places to hide when they're young. So you're simplifying the ecosystem.
That's an interesting description of it, simplifying it, meaning that you're just removing a large portion of the wildlife that's there.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. Okay. And as they overfished the herring and then the whitefish, the Clyde was basically left with two commercially viable species. That was prawns that lived in the mud and scallops that lived in the sand, gravels and mill. The fishing industry were down to a few species. With that few species also came huge job losses. So when we look at the fishing towns around the Clyde, around the Firth of Clyde where I live, over the last 20, 25 years, fishing boats and fishing jobs have reduced by over 70%. And that's due to poor government management, but also changing from catching fish, we caught all the fish, so we'll just dredge up what's left.
And you describe this process that changed the coast. You describe this as dredging. Is that the same as trawling?
So the dredging happens on specific substrates of sand, gravel, pebbles and cobbles. The bottom trawling that we see happens further out, and it is again scraping the bottom, but it's scraping the bottom with wires and nets to catch prawns, which live in the mud. But they both scrape the seabed.
What inspired you to create the organization called COAST?
Back in the late 1980s and 1990s, we kind of shrugged our shoulders and didn't kind of think, what can we do? A couple of local people. We've got no scientific background. We've not got no background in government and policy. But what changed was that Don was very fortunate that every few years he would go out to New Zealand where his wife had family. And he would go out there for a month or two in the winter. And he made it his task to track down a gentleman from Auckland University called Dr. Bill Ballantyne. And Bill and his colleagues at Auckland University in 1977, after 15, 20 years of campaigning, had set up the world's first no-take marine reserve in Lee. And so Don went to meet Bill. He phoned him up and Bill said, come along. And Bill became, for many years, our mentor. So we learned from what they did in New Zealand. And then twice Bill came over to the Isle of Arran and spent a week with us. And so we learned from his experience. And so they wanted to see what happens when you allow an area not to be fished and not to be disturbed. And the results in New Zealand were pretty extraordinary within 5, 10, 15 years. And so that we set out with the idea of setting up a no-take zone. And what we wanted was a low-impact fishing zone outside. In generally, you've got to remember, we live on an island, we live with lots of other people that include fishermen. And so we're trying to come up with a solution that doesn't put too much stress on people. These areas, the no-take zone is a fairly small area, but it took nearly 15 years to move to get that no-take zone and a further 8 to actually get the marine protected area round about it.
In order to have that no-take zone established, you did a lot of work to build community support for that. And another goal was to use technology to support your work there.
Yes. So for the first 4 or 5 years, it was very much Don and myself and a couple of friends sending off letters to councillors and to politicians. And we didn't really get anywhere at all. And so we looked at other examples, both in Scotland and in Europe, where basically you had bottom up. So a lot of the top down, in other words, governments trying to set these up had failed because the locals didn't like the idea. You need to convince the community it's a good idea. And that's really when COAST was, as a community organization, was set up. We convinced the community with giving talks, giving presentations to any village meeting around the island. In these meetings, we would use pictures of both sea angling and fishing from 10, 15 years previous that people would see people and recognize and say, oh yeah, look at all those big fish. We can't get those now. We started to realize that the visual image of photographs and charts and other things was a really good way of persuading people. You can bore people to death with PowerPoints that have got loads and loads of lines and talk away. But if you can introduce them to the kind of visual image, they understand it much quicker. And so one of the earliest things we did when we finally got some funding was we chartered a research boat to do sight scan sonars of the seabed. Now, that's a picture made of the seabed by sonar. When we got the pictures back from the research, even we were absolutely astonished at the state of the seabed, because the sonar pictures showed you a picture 200, 300 meters wide, and the whole bay just looked like somebody had taken a comb back and forward over it. It was all dredged back and forward. And so the sonar picks out the dredge marks. Those pictures were incredibly good, used visually and in presentations to say, this is what the bay looks like now. It's just all dredged away. But 10, 15 years previous, you were catching all this fish. And so the sight scan sonar was the first real move into any kind of technology. And then as a community, we were encouraged to be trained in Sea Search. Now, Sea Search is a UK organization that helps train amateur divers to record the seabed. And then all that recording goes into a national database. We also started to build relationships with universities, especially the University of York and Glasgow. With their help and knowledge, they would be starting to put their data using GIS, which to us was completely new. And to me, as someone who is much more of a visual person and loves maps and things, this was amazing. All this data going into all these maps, and the universities using GIS, Geographic Information System, or as we call it in the sea, a chart of the sea, but it's where you can put layers of information and data. So we can put layers of what type of habitat it is. Is it mud? Is it sand? In the last 5 or 6 years, we have been using GIS to map blue carbon habitat. Now, blue carbon is areas of the seabed, and it can be mud to algae or seaweed or seagrass. And so you can map these different areas of blue carbon. Now, many of us know that trees absorb carbon, peat bogs absorb carbon. In Scotland, our seas store 18 times more carbon than all our forests, all our peat bogs put together. And so our seas and seabed are a huge carbon store. The other thing that's really interesting is that many years ago, 20, 25 years ago, when we were talking to Bill Ballantyne when he was over from New Zealand, he said to myself and Don, he said, look, guys, if and when you achieve this no-take zone and the marine protected areas and you start monitoring it, things will happen that no scientist would ever predict. But you'll not find that out unless you are closely monitoring the sea. And so over the last 15 or 16 years since we've been monitoring the no-take zone and then the MPA, we forgot what Bill said 20 years ago. But then in the last 5 or 6 years, all of a sudden, this species, which is a hard bryozoan that resembles a small stag's horn coral, and its common name is a monkey puzzle bryozoan. First of all, we started seeing small patches of it. And the identification book for the bryozoan shows that it grows to about 3 or 4 centimeters or a maximum of a couple of inches. We would start seeing these grow in these patches. And then these patches would be 100, 150 millimeters or 6 inches across. They were growing to sizes that had never been seen by any scientist. It's a colonial animal. Like most things below about 15, 20 meters in Scotland, as the light fades, most of the things before I did my sea search courses that I thought were plants growing in the seabed are actually animals or colonial animals. And it creates a habitat, and the more of it. And so our budgets are quite small as a community organization. So we just do what we can do, which is the basic monitoring.
After 4 years of a no-take zone, what did you see?
The first couple of years, there's not a lot really happened. But after 3 or 4 years, you start to see different and new species all starting to sprout up from the seabed. So you see more algae or seaweeds, and as you get deeper, more red seaweeds, you're starting to see little sprouts of soft corals. So the seabed slowly starts sprouting back to life when it's left to its own devices.
And did it recover in the ways that you wanted it to? Did the species that you hoped would come back return?
Because it's quite a small area, you're never that sure. And that's where things like GIS and StoryMap really come in, because it means that we can tell the public sometimes quite complex scientific data in much easier to understand format. So in basically numbers and telling stories on StoryMap with pictures or videos, and then using GIS to mark out specific beds of where things are much more in profusion. It means we can record things not just in lots of boring lists and spreadsheets. It means we can record things in layers, interspersed with pictures and charts and video. It's an absolutely brilliant medium. All humans are all kind of terrestrial beings. And so we understand from being a child much easier what happens on land. And to many people, if you're not a diver like I am, understanding what happens on the ocean, it can be a bit of a mystery. But the being able to use videos and story maps and GIS, we can put quite complex data into it, and it will produce us maps of and maps and charts of specific, like seagrass, what areas are the seagrass beds? What areas are important to blue carbon? And we can use those both on our website, but just as importantly, we use them in our small visitor center. So we have a whole display explaining what blue carbon does. And that display, we use a GIS chart to show you the different areas that are important. So like kelp and seagrass, deep sea mud.
Let's talk about results. You told us how dredging just caused such a change for the community, for the livelihood of many fishermen there. How has life changed?
In the whole Clyde, which is a large area, it's only changed a little bit because there's still a downturn in fishing jobs. Locally, around the south of Arran, we are seeing an increase in the economy of diving, marine tourism, and in small-scale fishing. There are a lot more scallop divers now accessing over the last couple of years. So the no-take zone only made a little bit of difference. But once the in 2016, once the management came in for the South Arran MPA, which is substantially larger, at I think it's about 219 square kilometres. And so with the taking away the bottom toe gear, the actual results in the MPA quite often exceed the no-take zone. Now, in general, that is because the no-take zone is seeding these areas. So because in the no-take zone, you have more scallops, they're much larger, they're closer together, they potentially seed areas over 40 times the size of the no-take zone. So once you exclude dredging from the MPA area, it increases the species and the species that can still be fished, but in a much more sustainable way.
Have you found that other communities are interested in the work that you did to establish a no-take zone and replicating that process?
With the success, of course, from 2008 onwards, we were, and at that point, we were still volunteers. So we only had our first member of staff in 2011. We were kind of inundated by all kinds of people around Scotland and further afield about asking questions. In 2014, we started discussing with one of our larger partners, Fauna and Flora International, what was happening. And so between ourselves and Fauna and Flora International, we founded what is called the Scottish Coastal Community Network. Now that has grown from 6 communities around Scotland to this year being 30 communities. Each one of those communities, it's completely up to them how they want to recover the seas. Some would like no-take zones, some just want marine protected areas that don't allow destructive fishing. They know themselves the different damaging effects and what needs to be removed and what they should encourage. Coast started a lot of things, but basically it's now in Scotland much, much widespread. Just in the last week, we have joined with an organization which has just been set up called Revive the Ocean, which has basically been set up after the brand new latest David Attenborough film called Ocean. And so off the back of Ocean, we are partnering organizations in Mexico, in Turkey, in the Philippines and the Far East, in Spain, I think. So we're working in partnership with lots of organizations now. And in general, all these organizations are aiming to basically, so they're saying the 30-30, so 30% protected by 2030, which is a UN target.
Howard, thank you for talking with us today.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Esri and the Science of Wear podcast. And thanks to Howard Wood. If you like this episode, please share it with a colleague.